odd energy fluctuations.
On our way.
We're in a wormhole.
No, it can't be.
Are you stuck in a time loop?
What?
Time bugs. They're designed to paralyze an enemy ship by randomly cycling them through time.
This has to be Maul and Locke.
We came prepared. We saw our possible future. We can't let it happen. We cannot fail.
Transfer complete.
Hello, and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge.
This is Tyler Orton, giving a pep talk to my unconscious self from the past.
And we're here this week to talk about the latest episode of Star Trek Discovery, episode 4 of the season, Mirrors. No, wait, that was me screwing up last week. We are actually talking about Face the Strange.
Yeah, this one was written by Sean Cochran, directed by Lee Rose, and apparently there's flashing images, Cam. You and I, we're not joking about this. We're both epileptic. Yeah. Cam, were you worried going into this one?
No. You see, I see this like kind of warning quite a bit. You see it in front of like Star Wars shows or Marvel shows. I always find myself looking for the moments they're talking about. And I got to be honest, I guess it was the moments where they were just like pulsating before they had jumps in time, I guess. But it didn't stand out the way you get like, say, on The Simpsons when they were watching that robot show that was just like vibrating.
Right. In all fairness to me, I've never had a seizure triggered by flashing lights. So I wasn't too worried myself. But Cam, we kicked this one off 15 hours earlier. 15 hours earlier from what? I guess the previous episode, kind of explaining how we got that time bug into Adira's uniform there. I guess we're just kind of showing like how Maul and Locke are capable of murder. Mm-hmm. Do you think inevitably Maul and Locke are redeemed by the end of the season?
There's something about these characters that's kind of operating in the mystery box format here, where it's like, we know, first of all, we've talked about how, like, Locke, for example, they've been very vague about what his species is or who this character is. But, like, they keep talking about, like, the walls are closing in on us. We need to be free. How are the walls closing in on them, Tyler?
Well, Cam, that's a mystery, and you're just going to have to tune in next week to find out more about characters that we're not quite invested in because we don't understand what their motivations are.
Wait, you weren't won over when you found out Maul was related to Booker the Second or whatever it was?
the closest thing Cleveland Book has to family.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he shares a name with her biological father that she really isn't familiar with.
It's like they're really like trying to set up sort of a Badlands, Bonnie and Clyde kind of thing with
Badlands, yeah.
A lot of shots of wheatgrass blowing, you know, things
sure,
like that.
Sure.
But they aren't showing us that these two are actually being pursued or are in any sort of like threat of being stopped. It's more like they are pursuing something and Discovery is competing against them. But like, I don't have the real sense of like outlaws on the run from authorities.
No, no. We do get to see them make out. So I guess it's very explicit that they are a romantic couple. I guess they had established that before, but I think this is the first time that we see like real going at it after murdering a person. So there you go.
That was their turn on, I guess.
Yeah. Cam, I don't want to get into your head, but we jump back over to Discovery. This is one of the most awkwardly edited scenes in which all you hear is Ian Alexander's voiceover. You don't see him on screen when he's mm-hmm. talking to Adira. So I guess that's a cheaper way to pay the actor, you know, if it's only voice work, I suppose, because then you just flash over to kind of a hollow image of Gray and Adira in, I guess, their more romantic times.
Yeah, I thought that was odd as well. And the moment where the time spider revealed itself, I literally was like, wait, what just happened and what am I looking at?
Yeah. You know, I'm going to go backwards a little bit because I asked you a question that you didn't answer it.
Oh, in what sense?
Will Maul and or Locke be redeemed by the end of the season?
Right, yes, sorry, I was distracted with just the sense that these two characters are being mystery boxed here. But no, in terms of being redeemed, it's tough because, like, we're seeing them, like, kill people. Do I think they'll be redeemed, or will it be more of, like, a Romeo and Juliet ending where they both go down swinging together and that's, like, the end of their love affair? I feel like at the moment that's where I'm leaning more so.
Okay, it's just that Discovery is obsessed with second chances and redemption. You know, Tarka, by the end of it, he was kind of redeemed. Same with Book as well. And also, I just have, you have that connection between Book and Maul that they really want to emphasize. And I just wonder if it's anyone, like, maybe she's redeemed somehow, despite the fact that we saw her murder somebody just moments earlier.
The one thing I wonder is, like, because they're obviously not, they're obscuring, like, what these two are running from. Like, if they actually reveal that it is something that makes us more sympathetic to their cause, I could definitely see them pivoting and make it more of a, yes, these two have to serve time for their crimes, but they'll be together in the long run.
Just like Narek.
Still wandering around that android planet.
Yeah. Okay, Cameron. Now, from that moment with Adira, I guess kind of... I think you're right when you mentioned it last week that... I kind of envisioned, like, maybe it was the final goodbye to Gray, but I do think that there will be at least one more appearance of Gray by the time you get to the series finale. But it seems as if we're kind of closing the loop there between Adira and Gray. We jump over to the bridge, trying to figure out why it's just empty space. We have Reese suggests something and Rainer calls him an idiot, doesn't want to hear it. And then, ooh, if looks could kill, we see what Burnham does to Rainer. And it's interesting in that, like, they go into the ready room and it seems as if there's some self-awareness on the part of the writers when she's saying, like, yeah, we're a super close crew and we need to be really close. And the thing that irks me about this, it annoys other people, but, like, this is a paramilitary exploratory organization. And if, like, orders don't matter, if the chain of command doesn't matter, if you literally say, I love you to your colleagues almost every day.
Yeah.
It's just, it's silly. Like, it's legit silly. And it just doesn't seem as if there's any sort of efficacy in this. And it's just like, I kind of like Rainer being kind of the Shaw-esque character where he's like living in like the reality of the Star Trek universe.
Well, can you imagine if you go back to like the original series, if like random crew member of the week just like shouts out an idea to Kirk randomly, like it would just never happen. And Discovery, it is much more of that cheerleading squad where these people are just, they are the coworkers that have been together for like, it feels like decades. They just, it's all a lovin'. And so like, I kind of enjoyed watching Rainer as sort of the fly in the ointment here. And you have that great moment where Burnham is like saying, look, I want to do things my way. And he says something like, what if my way is better? Yeah, I was like, ooh.
I like that. I like that though. You know,
it was great.
But it's just, look, I understand maybe you run your own small business or it's like a tech startup and this is how you want to run things in terms of leadership style. I don't think this leadership style would actually work in a real circumstance like a starship, you know. It seems to work because that's how the writers write it, but it just seems like just so unrealistic, like this would be any sort of effective crew.
Yeah, well, like, so much of this show, too, it's weird because when you watch, like, say, Next Generation, or I mentioned the original series, the crew feels very organized. You know, they have group meetings where they're all gathered around, all the heads of their departments, contributing ideas. When it comes to Discovery, do you have any sense of, like, collaboration between the different department heads?
Yeah, no, we've seen it between, say, Stamets and Reno, I'd say.
Yeah.
You know? Beyond that, yeah, they don't have those typical observation lounge meetings that, were such a big part of TNG.
No, you don't have, like, you can never imagine a world where it's just, like, Culber just walking up to, like, you know, a different crew member and just being like, hey, I have some thoughts. The way that, like, on Next Generation you would have, like, say, like, Crusher talking to Worf about something.
Although every time Worf said, let's fire torpedoes at this unknown alien, he always got shot down.
That is also true. Yeah, he did not get to shoot them down.
Okay. So look, I was listening to a podcast, the Next Conversation, and they were doing their own review of the first two episodes. And they said it'd be funny if the crew, they're showing the crew putting on weight over the course of the season because they're not walking anymore. They're just doing personal transporters, you know, so they're not getting their steps in. So that got a good laugh out of me. But it's also kind of like the crux of like how they somehow at the exact right moment, the time bug struck as they were transporting. And now they're all the way back in the past. And it was funny because, like, you and I were talking about, like, I guess, like, Bryce is off the show. Mm-hmm. And we do get to see Bryce, like, back, albeit the initial bridge appearance, he was, like, unconscious on the floor.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, okay, is that, like some shot that I don't remember from, like, way back when? And that's how you insert Bryce into the series once again? Is this Bryce's farewell? And all that. But we do get some more Bryce going on here. But Cam, okay, what we're establishing here, though, let's get into it. We've got like kind of a one of those high concept time travel episodes in Star Trek. This is also more of a much more of a bottle episode as well in Star Trek. Mm-hmm. And it's also seen more of like a standalone episode that we're typically used to from Star Trek Discovery. So it's just like, okay, like it not only is Rayner kind of acknowledging some of the criticisms leveled across kind of the writing staff here, it does seem as if like the writers are doing something a little different than what we typically see on Discovery.
Yeah, I mean, I was honestly surprised that they went this route because I was really predicting another episode about finding pieces to lead to, you know, the progenitor's weapon. And so when this was established as kind of a high concept episode, I was having flashbacks to Magic to Make the Sanest Man Go Mad from season one, which, I don't know, one of the highlights of Star Trek Discovery. And so this episode gave me a lot of optimism that maybe this season will get some kind of standalones. There's that one coming up called like Whistle Stop or something. I'm like, give me my North Star part two.
Okay. I may have missed something. Now, is it like you mentioned the progenitor's weapon. Yeah. Is it a weapon or is it just technology that could be used as a weapon?
It's technology that could be used as a weapon, I believe. Yeah.
Okay. Okay, cool. So, Cam, we're now back in the Red Angel era.
Hallelujah.
As soon as that happened, I was just like, do we get Anson Mount? Do we get the return of Anson Mount at this point? Alas, we did not. Did you have like any hopes that we'd get like some big cameos?
I thought so. I mean, later on, they tease Lorcan. I'm like, boy, I'm having flashbacks to that Terra Firma or whatever it was called, two-parter, where they went to the Mirror Universe, and the whole time we're like, what's Lorca up to? Mm-hmm. Where could Lorca be right now? And I was like, mm-hmm. Well, can they not just pay Jason Isaacs to show up for 5 minutes on this show? Apparently not. But yeah, I was at this point expecting some cameos. I'm still waiting for those cameos.
Cam, the biggest return that we got was Bryce.
Yeah.
No, I'm sorry. I guess it was Arium, you know.
No, that's true.
So I guess it was Bryce and Arium got to come back. I'll leave my Arium thoughts until we get back to her on the bridge in a little bit here. But okay, so now we're establishing that there is kind of a time loop, sort of not a time loop, but like kind of time jumps going on. I think the next one we're at dry dock in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. You know, I was like, okay, so what do we do with that scene? And like, I guess we're kind of establishing like more and more of the exposition going on. I just wonder if this is supposed to be kind of like a hop through like all the big events that we've seen over the course of Discovery's run. You know, I don't know if like the dry dock moment really did it for me, but personally.
It felt like a change of just pace in terms of seeing a different like scenario that Discovery could be in.
Yeah.
So like I guess I appreciate it in that way because they were really just playing with what's outside the view screen when they were doing that. And it's like, oh, there's the San Francisco Bridge, you know, the Golden Gate Bridge. That looks really cool. It was very quick to like I think any viewer could identify instantly where they were. So I guess it's helpful in that regard in creating a different sense of atmosphere. But it also felt like put a pretty picture on the window while our characters have exposition.
Yeah. So we are establishing that they are figuring out what's going on. The thing is, they are taking a lot of leaps in logic and just going with it, and they happen to be correct.
Yeah, they're like, it's a neuroweapon. I'm like, okay, sounds good to me.
wait, no, they're saying it's not a neuroweapon.
Oh, they said it's not. Sorry, yeah. But they bring up the idea, yeah.
Okay, the next time jump. Okay, this made me groan, Cam. Burnham looks out the window, and she's like, battle of control. We're talking about the season two finale. And she's like, yeah, that was a tough one. And just the dialogue and the delivery of the dialogue, it just made me groan so hard, you know. I don't know. We'll get into it when we see, like, Sneakwa Martin Green from, like, the first season of Discovery in just a few moments. But there's just something about the delivery there. It just seems so, like play acting. You know, you're watching, like Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou, and it's kind of like that Wes Anderson play acting, kind of. And that's what it often seems like with the delivery of her lines so often, where it either goes from, like, this, like, super soft whispering to this just over-exaggerated, like, bug-eyed sort of, like, overacting all the time. And this is just kind of – it just doesn't seem organic to me when she's delivering dialogue this way.
Well, the fact that I wrote that quote as well means it didn't work for me, because it was kind of like that, almost like mugging for the camera. But I'm like, if you're going to do kind of a hopping through the greatest hits of Star Trek Discovery, like, I don't know. This battle, she said farewell, like, forever to her brother. Maybe that means something. You know, some people died, like that admiral whose name I'm blanking on, Cornwall.
Cornwall.
Cornwall. Yeah, she died. Like, things happened during that battle. It doesn't seem like they're interested at all in playing with kind of the context of it. Like, can you imagine, say this was a TNG episode, and Picard's going through this experience, and they flash to, like, the events of Best of Both Worlds, and Picard was like, boy, that sucked. Moving on.
That was a rough one.
Yeah.
And then he winks at the camera.
He's like, <"Aye." laughs>
No, but you know what I was thinking about when I was watching this episode was Picard's reaction to Tasha Yar during All Good Things, when he is jumping across time there. And I thought that was so much more effective in the cameos we were getting there, from Tasha Yar to Chief O'Brien. I thought that was done in a much more effective way than, like, hey, look, it's Bryce. Hey, look, it's Arium. And, you know, like, that's why I just, it was silly. Like, why not have, like, an Ethan Peck or an Anson Mount or Jason Isaacs, like, pop in? Even a, who's the actress? Nikki Sharma, who played Landry, who she gets a shout out as well. You know, like it just, why not even was it Rachel Ansarel who played Nan? You know,
yeah,
like, just like something a little bit more familiar than I guess Arium was supposed to be kind of the big one for people.
Yeah, and we haven't seen that character in quite a long time, so I guess that I mean, it worked for me, but it would stand out. But it does seem kind of odd, like, to me. To not work in more iconography from those episodes, like
iconography,
showing those images outside the window is fine, but, like, a lot of things happened in that battle that would make really cool visuals. You know, whether it was, like, Burnham flying surrounded by all the probe things or whatever they were.
The drones.
Having Serana show up in her ship.
The farmer who's suddenly a starship captain going, wee, look at me. I can battle space villains.
Having the Enterprise there with Pike. Like, have the Enterprise, like, swoop by the window. Like, something like that where you'd be like, that really reminds me of that specific moment, versus just kind of, like, CG zips and zaps outside the window and going, hey, it's the battle for control. I'm like, well, yeah, okay.
Don't worry, Cam. We go to when Osira took over the ship, and we've got, like, the kind of thugs in like those black S&M outfits there. We get a Jet Reno shout out. Mm-hmm. She's right there. But we don't even see Osira. You know, it's just like these little weird things where I think they really were, like, I get it. My suspicion is they wanted to do a real cheap episode. And if you are bringing in like these expensive cameos, you can't quite muster that, you know, with regards to what you want to do with the budget. But then it just kind of, it seems as if this falls short a little bit then. And what they're, in the emotions they're trying to spark in the audiences, like if you are cheaping out on who you'll pay, you know, salaries to, then I'm just like, eh. It feels as if this episode could have been that much better.
Well, okay. If you want to go cheap, I understand. And Jason Isaacs costs some money. Michelle Yeoh is going to cost you quite a bit of money to show up in this. So I'm like, I understand. Are you telling me Janet Kidder is outside of their price range?
Could very well be. She played Osira for audiences out there.
That's right. Yes, yes. Yeah. Why not just throw a stunt person in like green makeup and have them run down a hallway and be like, hey, look, it's Osira.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so now we jump
What about
forward.
Cowboy? Hold on. What about Cowboy? If you don't want to pay for Osira, what about Cowboy? He can't be that expensive.
No, I think he would have been more expensive than her.
Oh, you think so? Okay.
Yeah, he, like he's a working actor. I mean, he was on that procedural back in, like, the early 2000s. I think it was called Medium, you know? Mm. Like, I think it would have been a little bit more pricier to do that. But, okay, so we jump 30 years into the future. I didn't realize it was only 30 years. At first, I was like, oh, my gosh. They're finally going to explain the Calypso short trek that we saw all those years ago, mm-hmm. in which it's like, what was it, like 1,000 years in the future, something like that? Yeah. Discovery's just been sitting there for a long time, but Zora, I keep getting mixed up. Is it Zara or Zora, the AI within Discovery?
Zora.
Zora, okay. Zora's talking, is very solemn and all that. I'm like, oh, we're getting the Calypso explanation. I thought that this was what the episode is building up to. So I was really bummed out. Cam, do you think we get a Calypso explanation by the end of the series?
I don't think there's any chance anymore.
Yeah.
I think it would be insane in season 5 to be now acknowledging a short trek from between season 1 and 2.
Mm-hmm.
It would be very odd. So I have to think no. But this felt like almost like a band-aid of like, well, here's kind of our quasi take on Calypso.
Sure. Yeah. It still irks me though, because, and the reason it irks me is I think it was far and away the best short trek ever produced.
Mm-hmm.
It also irks me because the fella that wrote and maybe directed it as well, Michael, why am I blanking on the name? But he went on to showrun season 1 of Picard, and so it really got my hopes up that season 1 of Picard would be phenomenal based on that short trek. And season 1 of Picard was not phenomenal.
No, Michael Chabon, I believe, is
Chabon,
person,
yes,
right?
That's what it was. Yeah. Okay.
And like they kind of had like a nod to Calypso where it cues in on this moment and you have Zora listening to Doris Day sing Que Sera Sera. And it's like, oh, that kind of reminds me of Funny Face from Calypso. Like, it's kind of like they're working in elements loosely of movie musical moments. And then, and then the crew is dead that Zora's talking about. But they're using it more as kind of like something Burnham has to avoid versus like kind of dealing with the mythology that Calypso was building.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so now we're establishing the stakes in the series. You know, it's one thing for like 3 episodes in a row where you're like, they need to find this technology. This technology is so powerful, blah, blah, blah. And then we see what a Breen-equipped ship can do with the technology, which is destroy Starfleet Federation headquarters there. So, okay, now you are establishing the stakes with the mystery of the show. They're doing it much earlier in a season of Discovery than we're typically used to, so I'm okay with this decision here.
Yeah, me too. And we've had a lot of teases of the Breen. Do you think the Breen are going to play something of a role as we go forward?
I sure hope so, because what were they saying maybe last week's episode? Like, the Breen are like some sort of political struggle going on in the Breen Imperium right now.
Yeah, some sort of instability and like they're potentially dangerous or something along those lines.
I'd be down to see what, like, the new era of Breen look like at this point. But, Cam, we still have not gotten to see a peek at the Klingons in this era of Star Trek, which is just, I think they just don't want to open that can of worms in terms of, like, how different they might look in this era versus how they established them in the first two seasons versus how we're now watching, you know, Picard season three and Worf clearly looks like Worf, you know? So I understand why they don't want to open that can of worms, but it is so weird. We haven't heard anything about the Klingons, you know, three seasons into this era of Star Trek.
Well, we are, as you said, three seasons into the 32nd century of Star Trek Discovery. We have learned about the Vulcans and the Romulans, the Trill. Anything else?
We saw a Cardassian in the background of the season three premiere.
Yeah, and the president of the Federation is half Cardassian, half Bajoran, right?
And she has a she has a holiday cabin on planet Earth, even though Earth was isolated for all those years. But somehow her family would go visit Earth and holiday there.
That's right. We saw a changeling on a in the gambling episode.
Yeah, yeah.
But like, they haven't given any sort of exploration to these other alien species, which it's like, we've moved time periods to basically give you a blank slate. And the fact that they've dodged around doing that is kind of strange. I've never really understood why they did that.
Look, maybe, and that's why I think they think, maybe not the prime aliens so much. You know, what if we play around with something like the Breen? Maybe that's, it's not as if like future Star Trek shows, the mythology of those will rest on what the outcome of the Breen is 800 years in the future.
No, and I think that's a good idea, because the Breen aren't like a species that is massively important to just your general ongoing Star Trek stories. Kind of like, what Lower Decks does with some of its alien species that it deals with. It doesn't pick the, you know, the Klingons and make wild choices. It takes ones that people, like the Paklids, who aren't necessarily at the forefront of new Star Trek creators' minds. So I would love it if they did something with the Breen. That could be fun. I will say, I guess we left it off, but Discovery did deal with the Andorians a little bit with all the Emerald Chain stuff, but or not the Andorians, sorry, the Orions. But outside of that, yeah, not much.
No. Okay, now we've got that. I kind of like the moment where, like, Stamets is just, like, positing to Reno, like, hey, theoretically, what if this was going on? How would we address this? And then she finally said, are you in a time loop, Stamets? Like, that actually made me laugh. I did like that there.
Yeah, I thought that was fun as well. Like, there was some pretty good Stamets stuff in this episode. And that's a character that you and I were frustrated with being ignored in previous seasons.
Well, they did acknowledge that, like, the tardigrade DNA fundamentally changed the character from halfway through, not even halfway through season one, like one third of the way through season one onwards.
They did. And there's a line where Burnham says, oh, that's right, Stamets lives outside of time. And I had a moment where I was like, wait, what? And, you know, I immediately remembered in, of course, Magic to Make the Sanest Man Go Mad. But in the season since then, have you had an ongoing sense of Stamets being a man who exists outside of time?
No, I don't think that's what it was. I don't think they meant that like literally.
Okay.
It's just like, if there's like time anomalies going on, he wouldn't necessarily be affected by them, or his consciousness would realize what's going on, because they establish that in Magic to Make the Sanest Man Go Mad.
Yeah.
They just haven't had any like time anomalies in which that would have to come up again since then, though, right?
Yeah, you're 100% right there, yeah. And it just seems like the kind of detail that would have been interesting to work with a character, because Stamets, as we said, so often ignored. Why not try to kind of exploit these abilities he has?
But the thing is, I don't think that they've ever even thought about it since then.
Agreed.
And when they're breaking the story for this Face the Strange episode in season five, they're like, oh yeah, I remember back in season one, he was not affected by that time loop. Why don't we pull him in as part of the solution to what's going on here?
Well, exactly. It gives Rayner and Burnham someone to talk to, because otherwise you spend the whole episode of them trying to convince people.
Yeah. Okay. So we're jumping ahead a little bit more. They're doing more of the exposition. We've got Burnham going in, seeing Grudge in her quarters. And I guess this whole stuff with like her encountering Book from the past when they're still in a relationship. David Ajala, I need to get on his workout regimen. That's all I can say there. But it doesn't really do much for me when, like, I see her pining for what they used to have. Like, it just, I don't know. Like it wasn't like my heart went to flutter thinking about them as a romantic pairing.
No, like, the problem with Discovery is, like, because it always had this kind of, like, almost like melancholy or almost like moody vibe, that you never had the real sense of, like, them being a fun couple to hang out with. Like, you never felt that kind of exhilaration of love with the two of them. A lot of it was almost like depressing love.
Yeah.
Where it's like, well, we belong together because the world is against us. And you're like, oh, that's depressing.
It's like Ash Tyler as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. When I had them kind of reminiscing, the two actors I like, and I think they are good together, but I just wish we had more stories to reflect on and be like, oh man, remember that really great story about, you know, Burnham and Book together? Like with Worf and Jadzia, there are stories that I remember when I think of them as a couple.
Okay, but do you remember like in season 3, like we spent an entire season with Book and Burnham going, remember that time we did this? Remember that time we did that? Remember that planet? And that made my eyes roll so hard. Like, I agree with you. Like, I'd rather them, Discovery, it's always going to be a problem. I'd rather them show, don't tell. And I agree. I wish there were more, like, fun, adventurous times we saw them together one-on-one. In, like, cooler moments rather than like, hey, remember that time your locust, your space locust planet ended up getting destroyed by the DMA? Like,
I always think too of just like a fun moment on DS9 where it's like the double date with like Odo and Kira and Worf and Jadzia. And it's not like a big story driving moment, but it's like a fun little set piece to establish these two couples and the dynamic they have with each other. Like, they should have done something like that at some point. Have Burnham and Book hanging out with another couple on Discovery. Just give us that scene together versus like a lot of very kind of like sad downbeat scenes of, for example, like Culber, you know, giving people therapy. You know, it's like, let this show kind of like breathe. Let the characters have lives.
Yeah, I know. But the thing is that's the other thing, like, I think the writers are self-aware of, because they're like, going into season 5, we want this to be fun. And like, they're acknowledging that the show is kind of a bummer.
Mm-hmm. Which is what you want to do in your final season.
Yeah. Alrighty, so this is a kind of writing that annoys me, Cam. It's like, Burnham successfully collects the MacGuffin that's needed to destroy the time bug. But guess what, Cam? The time bug has a shield. So therefore, they need to do XYZ to defeat the time bug yet again. And to me, I don't like this writing because it's not about character decisions. It's based on like, oh wait, we're only 30 minutes in, how do we lengthen this process and get our characters to interact more? Like, it was just kind of a very arbitrary narrative device that they deployed here with the whole time bug now being able to disintegrate people's, I don't know, into timelessness or whatever.
Yeah, it's just like kind of fake you know, Star Trek science to explain why we need to prolong it. The time bug element of the story really didn't do anything for me. I preferred more just like what the characters were going through, but when it came to actual problem solving, it didn't do a heck of a lot for me there.
Yeah. Okay, so we jump forward into yet another little time dealio. This is a very, very like small window because this, okay, so we're back in season 1 and it's after Burnham is no longer in her prison fatigues, but it's before Landry is killed by the tardigrade.
Mm-hmm.
But she's away on she's out on a way mission with Lorca. So this had to have happened between like what, like episode 4 and 5, I think. Like that's what it seems to be. So I get like we have specialist Burnham in her uniform, and everybody's giving her the stink eye.
Yes, I believe it was the end of episode 4 where the tardigrade went, it was freed to go back to space, right?
Was it? Because the thing is, we don't get onto Discovery, we don't establish Lorca until episode 3, right?
Yeah, but...
So I think it had to be like episode 5 or 6 in which the tardigrade was freed.
Right, because the end of episode 3 is the snug as a bug in a rug.
Yeah.
You know, Landry saying that to Lorca. Then we set up the tardigrade in episode 4. And yeah, I think it's episode 5 they free it.
Okay. Okay. Okay, so, like, We're in the turbolift with Linus. He says, red suits you. He's always been a big sweetheart, despite the fact that she was a mutineer. Okay, good on him. He wasn't giving her dirty looks like the rest of the bridge crew was. But here we have Burnham awkwardly run into her past self.
Yeah.
To me, this is interesting because you and I have mentioned it many a time. We were just talking about it maybe last week as well. And like, her season one character bears absolutely no resemblance when you go from the season finale of season one to the season two premiere. Two completely different characters appear. Mm. It is a little like weird, or not weird, but it's real tossing you into like ice water when you see how different the character is in season one lined up exactly with like season five. It's not like watching an episode from season one and then watching an episode from season five. You're seeing the characters together. And it just kind of reminds me, like, I liked Sonequa Martin-Green's performance so much more in season one.
Yeah.
And I found the character far more interesting in season one than I do now.
I thought it was really fun to go back to that early Burnham and see her pitted against the current one. Like, it felt like a great obstacle for the episode, because at this point, as you said, they are so radically different that you can see how they would not necessarily collaborate well if thrown together. It's kind of that, though, telling versus showing, because the thing is, like, we've seen Burnham change over the seasons, but it's never been that specific as to why she's changed. And so, yeah, it was, I mean, there was even an interview Sonequa Martin-Green gave, I think it was this past week, where she's basically like, yeah, seasons one and two are really bumpy. There was a lot of problems going on. And we really found our footing in season three.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, well, I mean, maybe in terms of stability behind the scenes, perhaps, but in terms of what you're doing on the show, I don't know that I agree, but it seemed like she was very, very aware and finally admitting this. Yeah.
Yeah, and just for listeners that don't know, there was a lot of turmoil going on between different showrunners. There's a lot of revolving doors of writers in those first two seasons. But honestly, Cam, like, I thought creatively, like, Discovery is much better in those first two seasons, since that stability with Michelle Paradise as the showrunner since then entered the picture.
Yeah, well, exactly. And I mean, it was interesting. There was another interview where Sonequa Martin-Green was talking about this specific episode and said, like, she kind of had to, like, she was struggling to even get back to that Burnham, because she said, I know I was there and I, helped create these moments, but it was not necessarily easy to just jump back to it because I've come so far in terms of what I do with the character.
Okay. So now we have a Burnham versus Burnham fight sequence. I'm always pretty bored when Star Trek does fights. And this one was pretty long as well. We finally get the Vulcan nerve pinch. And as I was alluding to at the outset of this show, Burnham starts giving her past self a pep talk while she's unconscious.
Don't give up. Don't you give up.
It seems so silly to me.
Hang in there, baby.
We need to make that poster where Burnham from season one is hanging on to a clothesline.
I am willing to draw that, yes.
Okay. Now we get Grumpy Stamets, which, again, we were talking about this very recently. Funny just to see. I mean, he we don't see, like, the real contemporary Stamets. It's like he's playing his old self, you know, prior to the tardigrade DNA. Mm-hmm. But it was kind of a fun moment to see how different he was back, you know, in the first, his first three or four appearances on the show.
Yeah, when he really, like, was fun as a character, and you're like, oh man, this is so different than what we typically get on Star Trek. And then I guess what we got was also pretty different than what we get on Star Trek, but it was weird. I like this earlier Stamets. I thought that, like, you could just tell Anthony Rapp was having a lot of fun with this, and I was on board for it.
Yeah. Okay. So, Kim, were you surprised we never got an Ash Tyler shout out throughout all of these time jumps?
Yeah. Why not? Like, give us something. Like, that's the thing. It's like, I like the concept of this episode. I like bouncing around to different time periods in Star Trek Discovery, but it's like, throw us in a little bit of set dressing. Like, why not have an Ash Tyler moment? Why not? Like, that would have been fun, I think, for the audience.
I think, honestly, I think they knew that that character just did not work at all.
Mm.
And they're kind of like, yeah, let's just forget about it. Like, what does this add? You know, it would have been fun if, like, so you have that time jump where she's with, like, Booker, and then the next time jump, she could have been with Ash Tyler, and just her different reactions to these different romantic partners over the ages. Like, that would have been fun to witness. But again, I think they were cheaping out on the character cameos that we were getting out throughout this episode.
Yeah, no, I agree. Like, they just, for whatever reason, decided to... It's weird because, like, you think if you're going to make a bottle episode, you have to do something a little bit cheaper just to save on your budget. You would pick something that doesn't constantly remind the audience of what they're not seeing.
Yeah. Okay, so Cam, we're on the bridge. It's season one era. They are like, you're not allowed to be on this bridge. Going backwards just a little bit. In the Turbo Left, like, Burnham was, like, calling her a shape... Like, past Burnham was calling contemporary Burnham, like, a shapeshifter. But I'm like, if she's a real shapeshifter, why doesn't she, like, mimic your current hair and your current uniform? Like, that makes her a stupid shapeshifter, doesn't it? Like, she's not even wearing a Starfleet uniform that anyone would recognize in this era, like, 800 years earlier.
It is kind of odd. I thought, though, in terms of dumb moments... Maybe the dumbest thing she did was, after the nerve pinch on early Burnham, they just leave her lying unconscious in the middle of the corridor. Like, don't you want to, like, hide the body or something like that so you're not going to have other complications ensue?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, but the other thing that was dumb is, like, okay, she gets onto the bridge, and they're like, computer, where's Burnham? I'm detecting two Burnhams. And none of them are like, oh, maybe this woman. I get it. You have to be skeptical. Everybody was skeptical of Burnham in this era. But... Mm-hmm. It's like, wouldn't that be enough saying, like, oh, if there are two confirmed, verified life signs of Burnham, maybe she is what she is saying. I get what the episode is trying to accomplish, which is, like, it's all about connection, Cam. It's about how you connect to people and how she was able to convince people of this through her connection. I'm going to bring this up. Burnham says to Arium, I miss you every day. And I'm like, okay, but you haven't mentioned her on screen in 6 years. Okay, I don't buy that at all.
No, I didn't either. That felt a little false. I mean, we did get that one episode where Arium did something.
yeah.
But they basically ignored the character up until that episode. So that felt like a bit of a reach. I was just thinking, though, do you think part of the reason... they kept Jason Isaacs off screen other than money.
Yeah.
Is because if you suddenly have two Burnhams, it starts to invite questions of him thinking maybe it's the Mirror Universe Burnham.
I bet the writers did not even have that discussion. I honestly bet the writers are like, we need to do a real cheap episode. And that's, yeah. So, like, I know what you're getting at, but I honestly think that the writers were not even entertaining the idea of, like, bringing in, like, a Michelle Yeoh or a Jason Isaacs or an Ethan Peck or an Anson Mount for this particular episode. That's a bummer.
Yeah. I mean, Rekha Sharma, they could have afforded her, right?
Yeah, but I honestly think they were trying to do this as cheap as possible. Like, you know, Hannah Cheeseman, who plays Arium, way cheaper, way, way, way cheaper than, like... I'm sorry. I said Nikki Sharma. It's Rekha Sharma.
Yeah.
I apologize for getting her name wrong earlier on as well. But, like, yeah, like, it's just kind of like, I really think they were trying to keep the, like, cost levels down as much as possible. Like, this is a bottle episode as well, you know. Like, also, like, Ian Alexander doesn't even appear on screen. Like,
true.
It's just his voice that we see or that we hear.
And maybe that's the biggest giveaway in terms of saving money. The fact they wouldn't even pay for a visual. Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah, the time bug stuff. They're in engineering. Stamets is confronted by Reese as well as Burnham. And this is where things, I'm just like, oh, now the episode is about Rayner learning about connection and how it's good that he remembered that Reese really likes Constitution class starships.
Finally, he remembered something about a crew member. And it's funny because I think it was last episode we were talking about Rayner. Maybe it was the one before that. I don't remember. But, like, I was saying by the end of the season, he would be a cheerleader in there with all the other Discovery crew. It's coming sooner than later.
Oh, yeah. So, Cam, okay. I get that they established that, like, okay, if we fix this time bug stuff, everything will go back to normal. The whole, like, memory, their memories will be... gone, it's not going to affect future timelines. I still think it's a little, like, sociopathic to tell Arium, you're going to die in about a year. And I'm just like, okay. Like, like, I felt bad for Arium in that moment, but then it was also very weird because, like, okay, Burnham is saying, Arium, you're going to sacrifice yourself for the crew. And everyone's calling Burnham's bluff, saying, no, she would never sacrifice herself for the crew. You're a phony. You're not from the future. And I'm just like, oh, okay, well, I'm sure that's a little offensive towards, like, Arium, who is somebody who did prove herself willing to sacrifice for her crew.
Yeah.
She knew that in her core, and that's how she realized that this Burnham is from the future. But the rest of the bridge crew are like, no, Arium, you would never sacrifice yourself for us.
Did you buy that that's what would work on Arium?
Like, no, I thought, not at all.
It's like, yeah, okay, like, if someone came to me and said that, I might deep down know I would do that.
I wouldn't.
But do I believe if a stranger is telling me that you have to believe I'm from the future because you're going to do this in a year? I'd be like, well, this is not evidence of anything.
Is there nothing deeper she knows about Arium that she could have told her at that moment?
I mean, do you know anything deeper about Arium?
She had a fiance who was killed in a shuttlecraft accident, and Burnham got the cybernetic implants. But the thing is, like, I'm sure that's all available in, like, records that, like, even, like, prisoner Burnham could have, like, looked up, you know? So I'm just trying to, I don't know, you know, maybe Arium really likes Scottish dirges, and that's why Saru performed one in that funeral following her death, and she could have pulled that out of her hat. I don't know.
Yeah, it felt like they should have maybe, like, had some sort of detail that would be more, I think, likely to sway Arium than, well, you're going to do this. It's like, okay, I can't take your word on that. This is a pretty important job I have right now, and I can't be, like, handing over the ship to you.
Yeah. Cam, there's another moment, like, that irked me where, I forget who exactly said it, but essentially, like, you know, Burnham is successful with this mission. You know, they figure out the time bug dealio, you know, Rainer sticks his hand in it. I was kind of hoping that when his hand came out, it would look more like a Picard's hand in Timescape when he reached for the fruit bowl, and, like, his fingernails were, like, super long. But somebody shouted out, "She did it! She did it!" And then somebody else said, "She always does." And I just I wanted to scream. I'm just like, yes, this is, like, Discovery at its worst, where it's Messiah Burnham. What's better, Cam, as a nickname, Messiah Burnham or Martyr Burnham?
I like Messiah more.
Messiah Burnham. Okay. Messiah Burnham, no matter what, she's always successful. Does she die in the last episode, Cameron?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I feel like if this is the fun season, it doesn't end with her dying.
But, like, the ultimate sacrifice.
Well, and also they did do reshoots on the final episode. I feel like if she died, they would have actually built the arc of the season to be about her dying. If they thought there was a chance of another season, I feel like Burnham was not going to die.
Yeah, you're totally right there. Okay. I'm sure there's going to be some other, like, sacrifice she makes somehow, you know.
Oh, guaranteed.
Okay. I don't know. Okay, so, you know, like, Rainer learns how to connect. At what point did you think that this, like, I figured pretty early on, like, this is going to be kind of a two-hander, and it's all about, like, Rainer learning the ropes and coming to realize that Burnham knows how to command.
Yeah, I mean, you have that scene of the two of them going head-to-head in the ready room, and a scene I actually quite liked, but it felt like, okay, this episode is about Rainer understanding Burnham's point of view and kind of aligning with her values on the ship.
Okay. Well, I'm trying to think, like moving forward, like, okay, we have 10 episodes. We have X number of, like, puzzle pieces to, like, find at this point. Like, I just wonder, like, how Discovery has this weird habit of, like, being, like, really slow and then everything picking up, like, at rapid speed in, like, the last two episodes. And it kind of feels as if, like, that's the same pace we're gonna be heading into as we wrap up this season. Like, so we're almost halfway through the season, Cam. Almost halfway through the season. Like,
yeah,
and we're doing, like, standalone adventures like this as well. So, it's interesting. You know what? I wanted to ask you this, you know, and by Actually, no, I'm not going to ask you anything. I'm going to make a statement that sounds like a question. But okay. Do you agree with me that this is probably the strongest episode of Star Trek Discovery since early season 3?
Yeah, 100%. And we had a lot of nitpicks up, you know, with it, but like honestly, I had a lot more fun watching this episode of Star Trek Discovery than I have an episode of this show in a long time. And I was making notes like, this feels like an episode I would have watched in season 1 and 2, and maybe it wouldn't have been my favorite, but I did enjoy it.
I think the key here is like, it's not the VFX extravaganza that draws me into Discovery. It's you're working with characters. You're not spending tons of money. Like, this is a bottle episode, and that means that you have to set the drama around like character interaction, and that's what we got here. And I thought this episode worked like better than anything I've probably seen since like Forget Me Not in early season 3. I don't know if this is better or worse than Forget Me Not. I think it's probably better than Forget Me Not. It's just been a long time since like I've watched an episode of Discovery and be like, oh, that's actually pretty good.
It has a lot of the cheese ball stuff that is just stock and trade in Star Trek Discovery, you know, connection and some of the Burnham moments that we referenced. But like, this episode felt like a fun way to handle some of the more grating elements of the show. It's like they're there, but they're in a package that's fun to move along with, and it's pretty zippy paced, and you've got some fun character interactions. And honestly, like, I thought the kind of pairing up of the two Burnhams was like a fun little concept, and obviously could be done cheaper, and it worked for me. Like, it was a novelty, and there's a lot of episodes, especially in season 4 Discovery, where if you were to ask me about it, it would be like, I don't know, it was like a kind of a smear of an episode. Like, I'm sure it continued plot points, but that's about it. Whereas this episode actually, it clicked with me, and it will stick with me as to, you know, what this hour was about.
Are we grading on a curve, though? Is this a solid episode of Star Trek, or is this a solid episode of Star Trek Discovery?
I think it's leaning towards Star Trek Discovery.
Yeah.
Like, if I'm to look at, like, the all-time high-concept episodes of Star Trek across all the series, like, this isn't ranking in my top... Well, I'd have to sit there and look at how many there are on the list, but it would not be standing next to Conundrum or something.
Well, yeah, well, exactly. Like, I'm glad you brought that up, because I think that's kind of like the perfect comparison about like Conundrum. It's not a top 20 episode of TNG, but it's a really solid episode. You know, kind of a cause and effect, a Conundrum, Remember Me sort of deal. This is nowhere close to that kind of level of, you know, solid high concept sci-fi Star Trek deals.
No, but I appreciated the effort, and I wouldn't say it's as good as Magic to Make the Sinist Man Go Mad either. Like, that episode was more fun and just had some really playful ideas. This one is kind of like the lesser version of that, but given that that was like one of my favorite episodes of Star Trek Discovery, I don't know that you could go super wrong trying to replicate that a bit.
Is Magic the best episode of Star Trek Discovery, period? Was that its narrative high point for you?
There's a couple episodes in season 2 that I really like. I'd have to honestly go back and do a rewatch to decide an actual ranking, but Magic is probably my favorite episode. I think it is my favorite episode of season 1.
I would say that it is my favorite episode of Discovery, and that just the emotions that I got from that episode never been replicated again since watching Star Trek Discovery moving forward. And, you know, there's a couple episodes, like, what was that episode 2 of season 2 in which they go onto that more primitive planet?
Oh, New Eden.
New Eden. That felt very Star Trek to me.
Yep.
You know, If Memory Serves was a really solid affair as well. But man, I'm just like, I'm trying to think of other ones that may be in the running versus Magic. And I can't really think of any.
Into the Forest We Go from season 1, which was the one with her and Cole facing off, was a good episode. That one jumps out to me. As well as the early Mirror Universe stuff. Despite Yourself, where they first arrived there, and the second episode where Ash Tyler was revealed, The Wolf Inside, I think that one was called, that one was pretty strong as well.
They are, but like neither one of those episodes exceed Magic, just for me personally, though.
No, I would agree with that, yeah.
Okay, well, look, so going into this one, Cam, I wasn't necessarily looking forward to watching, like, episode 4 of season 5. I was just like, okay, I'm gonna turn it on. We'll see what like magic puzzle piece they've got to find next, and see what stage of sorcery this is going to lead to. And I was just like, okay, this episode actually made me like a lot more delighted with the show.
Yeah,
I'm sure it's gonna let me down next week, but at least I don't have that same feeling where like, where I was kind of feeling a little bit more like a chore. Yeah, so this was definitely not a chore to watch, and I'm legitimately like looking forward to what they might try to do next week.
Yeah, me too. Like this season has not felt like a rough journey for me so far.
Yeah.
You know, we're four episodes in. I've, you know, in varying levels enjoyed all four of them. This does not feel like season four Discovery at all, where it really was a chore for me to sit down and watch them. There was nothing I was looking forward to when we were getting to like episode 6, 7, 8, 9 through that season.
Yeah.
And I think it's also like noteworthy as well, when you think of these 10 episode seasons, when I think of like Picard episode 4, that's the introduction of Elnor, that episode, like, okay. And then what was season 2 episode 4 must have been rough as well, I have to imagine.
They were in LA at that point.
Yeah.
Everything that had to do with LA was absolutely awful.
Yeah, it's the second episode of LA, so I think it's them escaping from ICE and whatever. So like that's not good. That is not a good hour of television. Whereas I feel like the first 4 episodes of this season have been more confident in kind of moving across a 10 episode season in a way where I feel like I'm being carried along by it versus getting frustrated.
This is just off the top of my head. I could be wrong, but I think episode 4 of season 2 of Picard ended with Rios being arrested by ICE, because in episode 3, they land in LA. He gets injured. He's in the clinic. And then is it
right?
The episode after is when like he spends an entire episode at the clinic. And then the episode after is when he's arrested by ICE?
Or he's arrested at the end of the episode or something. And the next episode, episode 4, is the one dealing with it. Yeah.
Yeah. So, anyways, everything that has to do with LA and Picard season 2 is just god awful.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. But this so far is shaping up to be a decently paced 10 episode season. So that is a plus, because I've watched not just Star Trek, but other shows that are 10 episode seasons where they can't hold it together either. So, you know, this is a nice change of pace for me.
Okay, then. Well, Cameron, next week we are coming back with episode 5. And Cam, can you get the episode title right this time?
I'm going to say Mirrors.
Yeah. I want you to say Mirrors every single episode moving forward.
What would be really funny is, now that I've said we're going to tackle Mirrors twice now, if we watch Mirrors and it's the most forgettable, nondescript episode ever, and it's like, well, that was not worth the promotion.
Well, do you think that they're putting Mirrors as, I don't know, just to kind of troll the fans, maybe expecting like a Mirror Universe episode?
I would think that, but then there's been several times where you and I have pondered that with upcoming episodes. I think of like the short trek called Q&A. Where it's like, oh, do you think they mean like a Q appearance?
Yeah.
And it's like, sometimes I just think they're like, nah, whatever. We're not thinking about it.
Yeah, I think people hoping for a Mirror episode, Mirror Universe episode, might be reading a little too much into a single noun.
Yeah. And I think if it's episode 5, basically the halfway point of this story, the next episode is going to be a check back in with Locke and Maul, and probably set up where we're going to go through the second half of the season.
Yeah. Okay, then. Well, Cam, we will be back next week with Mirrors.
That's right. And of course, you can leave reviews for us wherever you get your podcasts. Those are much appreciated. You can also find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam, V as in Vesper Martini, Ice Cold Smith.
You can find me at Reportin. That's R-E-P, P as in Pinchin' Nerves, O-R-T-O-N.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed. Hang in there, baby.